Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. I'm your host, Stephen Lyons, a member of the National Book Critics Circle. Today we welcome Dina Temple Raston, author of The Jihad Next Door, published by Public Affairs. Ms. Temple Raston is the FBI correspondent for NPR News. Her first book on race in America, entitled A Death in Texas, won the Barnes & Noble Discovery Award and was chosen as one of the Washington Post's best books of 2002. Her second book, Justice on the Grass, on the Rwanda genocide, was a Foreign Affairs magazine bestseller. She has two books related to civil liberties and national security out this year. The first, In Defense of Our America, from HarperCollins, was written with Anthony Di Romero, the executive director of the ACLU, and that looks at civil liberties in the post-9/11 America. The second book, the one we'll be talking about this morning, The Jihad Next Door, is about the Lackawanna Six, America's first so-called sleeper cell. Ms. Temple Raston most recently was on a two-year sabbatical in which she did these two books, learned Arabic, and received a master's degree from Columbia. Ms. Temple Raston holds a bachelor's degree from Northwestern University and a master's degree from Columbia University School of Journalism. She was born in Belgium, and French was her first language. To top it off, if that's not enough, she also speaks Mandarin Chinese. My goodness. Well, we of course welcome your phone calls. The number is 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455 if you're out of the area. Let me introduce The Jihad Next Door by reading a snippet from the Public Affairs, from the book, in fact. And here it is. They called themselves the Arabian Nights. Some said they traveled to Afghanistan to become America's first sleeper cell. Others said that their ill-fated trip was a lark, an adventurous extension of their youthful wrestling with what it meant to be Muslim in America. This is the story of a group of young men born and brought up in small-town America who left otherwise unremarkable lives to attend an Al-Qaeda camp. Though they sought to quietly slip back into their roles as middle-class Americans, the 9/11 attacks made that impossible. Dina Temple Raston, welcome again to Focus 580.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Maybe you could just start us off at the beginning. Who are the Lackawanna Six, and where do they come from?
Well, Lackawanna is a former steel town up in western New York, very close to the Canadian border. It's about 20 miles from Niagara Falls. The Lackawanna Six were six young men who, in the spring of 2001, traveled to Afghanistan and actually attended an Al-Qaeda camp. And what makes them interesting, and the reason why I wanted to write this book, was because they are, in a way, the perfect case study for what's going on in this country right now in terms of what it's like to be Muslim in America and the way our justice system has been sort of meting out justice post 9/11. I mean, the subtitle of the book is The Lackawanna Six and Rough Justice in the Age of Terror. And what this looks at is that justice system.
What attracted you, besides that, to the story? And did you interview the young men?
I didn't interview the young men, but I did see some classified paperwork that essentially was their telling of the story of going. And I saw that for all six of the young men, so I was able to sort of buttress the stories. And in addition to that, I talked to a lot of their family members and friends and people in the community, and that made it much easier. I was originally attracted to the idea because it sort of goes with the other things that I've written that you talked about. A Death in Texas was about white-on-black prejudice in this country. Justice on the Grass was about black-on-black prejudice in Rwanda, Hutu versus Tutsi. And I wanted to take a look at what it was like to be Muslim in America, the prejudice that we now have, I think, post 9/11, as non-Muslims against Muslims in America.
And I think it's important to, again, tell our listeners that these are Americans. They were born in America.
That's right. Okay. And that, you know, they were Americans. They went to American high schools. They, dressed in that sort of hip-hop fashion that teenagers like to dress in, and voted Democrat. And, were in many ways just sort of across the board, very normal teenagers.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's just jump ahead so that listeners know sort of, I wouldn't say the end of the story, but but where the six of them are. Five are incarcerated, and one is at large, correct? Or one is dead, I guess.
Well, actually, the number Lackawanna 6 is sort of a misnomer because there are more people than that involved in the actual case. I mean, it might be more accurate to say Lackawanna 9 or 7, depending on how you count. Six people were actually indicted for going, and one of those six is a guy named Jabbar Elbana, who was from Lackawanna and never returned. And he's on what the FBI calls a catch-and-release program in Yemen. Ironically, the mastermind between the USS Cole, al-Badwi, who there was a controversy in the news just yesterday about whether or not the Yemenis had actually released him. He seems to be on the same catch-and-release program, whereas the Yemenis know where he is but don't always have him behind bars. And that's what has happened with the sixth of the Lackawanna Six.
And five of them are not far from here in Terre Haute, Indiana.
Indeed.
And some of them will be released in the next couple of years. I believe they all went through plea bargaining. I think they were facing much more lengthy terms.
They got between 7 and 9 and 9 years, sort of across the board.
Okay, they were arrested almost a year after 9/11, 9/9/02, in fact, and one of them was in bed with his teenage bride on his wedding night
In Bahrain.
In Bahrain, yes, when the police burst through his hotel.
And the FBI swears up and down that this the timing of these arrests, which was almost exactly on the anniversary of 9/11, was all coincidental.
Mm-hmm. When did the investigation begin, and what drew the FBI to these young men?
Well, this is something that's actually quite interesting about what's going on today in terms of homegrown terrorism in this country. And clearly, I covered this a lot for NPR as the FBI correspondent. And one of the big unsung heroes in this scourge that we seem to have is the Muslim community in America. In nearly all the cases, Muslims within the community have let authorities know that something is amiss, and that's how they've found out. In the case of the Lackawanna Six, they got an anonymous letter almost as soon as they left for the camp. So this is even before 9/11. They got an anonymous letter from somebody in the Muslim community who said, look, these guys have gone off to train for jihad, and I'm scared for my life, and you should know who they are, and it named them. So before they had even finished training in Afghanistan, the FBI was already watching them.
Would this be part of the general chatter that was the FBI was investigating?
No, this, you know, not at all. In fact, this was sort of an overt act that was not part of the chatter at all. I mean, it came out of thin air, so much so one of the main characters in the book, a guy named Ed Needham, who is the sort of FBI agent in charge of this particular case, thought that maybe this was some sort of poison pen letter or some sort of grudge, because he couldn't believe this could be possibly going on. And then as he started sort of checking out the names that were in the letters, he started seeing that these guys actually weren't in town. They were actually traveling, and details in the letter began to check out.
Now, Ed Needham is somebody that you profile quite well, I think. He's a local. He's from South Buffalo, and he worked for the bin Laden hunter John O'Neill, correct?
Yes, it's kind of amazing what a small community it is. He worked for him, and also in the way that he sort of went forward with this particular case that I found interesting was, you know, he used to be a social worker, so he saw this really in a social context, not just a law enforcement one.
And how is he ultimately viewed after the arrest?
Who, Ed Needham?
Yes.
He's actually still quite popular within the community. I mean, the community is actually quite grumpy about the fact that the Lackawanna Six have been moved from prisons that were close to Lackawanna, which was part of the promise in the plea bargain, to Terre Haute. There's a special communications monitoring unit there where they've basically taken really sort of hardcore Muslim terrorists or Islamic terrorists and put them in this particular unit, and they put the Lackawanna Six in there too. And one of the questions I bring up in the book is whether this was all that wise, since they were clearly sort of keystone jihadists to a large extent, and now they're all together again, and what's more is they are with these sort of much more hardened terrorists.
Who is Kamal Derwish, and what role did he play?
Kamal Derwish was a young man who had been born in South Buffalo and had, as a youth, been in Lackawanna. And then his father actually worked at the steel mill. And when the steel mill broke down, when the steel mill closed and they shuttered it, he moved to Saudi Arabia. And Kamal Derwish became a very fervent Muslim while he was there and then came back to Lackawanna in 2000. basically wanting to recruit for al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm. And he saw this community as quote, virgin territory.
Yes, because, you know, you had a lot of, and this is what the book goes into in great detail. It has to do with how this recruiting takes place. You know, when we look at, say, the Fort Dix plot or these various things that we hear about, and we hear about these young men who have sort of been brought into this jihadist fold, I think it's very hard as a non-Muslim to understand how this could possibly happen. And the book goes through very carefully how this recruitment process does happen. And basically, he saw Lackawanna as the perfect place because people were underemployed. They had too much time on their hands. They didn't have many prospects. And they were trying to bridge two worlds, a Muslim world and an American world. And they were having trouble doing that. And Kamel Derwish sort of preyed upon that.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, he met a very infamous death, you could say, and one that was quite trumped up in the news, if I remember right.
Can you but if you that? Remember correctly, his name was never mentioned.
Correct.
There's never been, Kamel Derwish was actually killed by an American-shot Predator missile in the deserts of Yemen. And to this day, the U.S. government has still not admitted to killing him. It was an extraterritorial assassination. And they actually had sort of a black ops guy, a U.S. black ops guy, go up to the smoldering ashes of the convoy and break open the femur of who they thought Kamel Derwish was and take a DNA sample and compare it to his uncle in Lackawanna to make sure it was him.
And was it confirmed that it was him or never confirmed?
Publicly?
Yes.
Never publicly.
Okay.
But it's confirmed.
All right. Okay. Now I want to revisit that later because I think it says a lot to these what we're willing to do to protect ourselves.
I agree.
And we'll get back to that in a little bit. Derwish said about this is something I'm glad you put in the book because it raises a lot of questions. And that is the celebration, if you will, of the bombing of the USS Cole within the first ward of Lackawanna, New York. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, let me talk about the first ward a little bit first,
mm-hmm.
And that is that, and I was rather surprised to find this out, the second largest Yemeni or Muslim community in the United States is in Lackawanna, of all places.
Behind and Dearborn, Michigan, probably.
Exactly, yes. Exactly, close to you. And I'm not sure why I just didn't, I knew that there was a big Muslim population in Michigan, but I had no idea that there was this huge Muslim population in western New York. And this was because when the steel mills were really sort of hot and going about, you know, in the 50s and the 60s, a lot of people from Yemen were brought in because they thought, because they lived in the desert, it would be easy for them to work in front of the furnaces because they were used to that kind of heat. So a whole generation of men came. And then, you know, the succeeding generations with the steel mills closing really didn't have anything to do. And this is part of the problem. What Derwish actually played upon was that problem.
Mm-hmm. And he told the group, and I'm reading from your book, that that it wasn't so much an act of terrorism, the bombing of the USS Cole, as much as an act of defense.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he used to sort of talk to the young men in sort of these Socratic ways, you know, and they would say, oh, well, you know, suicide bombing is bad. And then he would say, is it? And then they'd all sort of talk amongst themselves about it. The USS Cole, the way they saw it in the Yemeni community there in Lackawanna was that it was a military target and that the Cole shouldn't have been there in the first place. So when the bombing actually happened, there was a huge sort of outpouring and sort of pounding in the air of, you know, see, Yemen is getting them. And it was less a pro-Al-Qaeda thing than a sort of little guy got the big guy thing. What's interesting is that was the first time that Ed Needham, the special agent at the FBI in Buffalo, was aware of the Yemeni community there. And he actually went there for a totally different reason. After the USS Cole was bombed, he went there because he was worried that there would be some sort of hate crime backlash, and he wanted to talk to the community leaders there to assure them that the FBI would help if they needed any help.
Mm-hmm. Why did these young men go to Afghanistan? What did they hope to find religiously? In religious terms?
That's a good question. I think that that gives them perhaps a little more depth than they really have. I'm not sure that they were looking to find something religiously. I think they were looking for adventure. You know, in order to have any sort of street cred on this particular story, I felt that the only, and people kept talking about how they'd gone for the adventure, and I had trouble sort of buying that. I actually followed in their footsteps from their villages in Yemen through Pakistan to the jihadi hotels that they stayed in, snuck across the border into Afghanistan, and went right to sort of the precipice of where these camps were to see if there really was that sort of James Bondian, I'm a spy, adventure, adrenaline rush. And, you know, I've done a lot of nutty things in my journalism career and exciting things and that sort of thing, and I got swept up in the adventure of all of this, of, you know, wearing a burqa and being in disguise and being in the sort of Wild West atmosphere. So the fact that, you know, these six guys from Lackawanna who really didn't have the same sort of experiences that I did, I completely understood how they got sort of swept up in the adventure of it all.
Mm-hmm. And what would you say is a jihadi hotel?
Oh, jihadi hotel, I don't know if I actually make this comparison in the book, but what I've been saying on the tour is essentially, you know how there are AARP hotels where you get a deal if you're 65 or older? It's kind of part of a network. There's actually a book that sort of shows you what AARP hotel is. Well, it's sort of the same thing. It's a hotel that helps funnel these young jihadists to the camps, not just at Al-Qaeda camps, but any sort of jihad camps or out to the border in Kashmir and that sort of thing. And usually they're run by men who are sympathetic to the Islamic Brotherhood cause and basically either charge them next to nothing or very little and stack up these young men like cordwood and make sure that the contacts that they're supposed to make to funnel them in an orderly manner into these camps actually works. And I'm not sure that jihadi hotels have ever really been discussed publicly before. It's something that you know, law enforcement, FBI, and that sort of thing have known about, and they watch them because it helps them figure out, you know, who might be tracking to these camps. What's amazing about the one of the jihadi hotels that they were in Karachi, just weeks earlier, Massawi, the so-called 20th hijacker, mm-hmm. was there.
Oh, that's right. I remember you saying that in the book.
Yeah.
Let me give our listeners the phone numbers again. Locally, 333-9455. Out of town, 800-222-9455, if you want to speak with Dina Temple Raston, the author of The Jihad Next Door. What did they find at the camp? I mean, I think they were quite surprised to find what they found.
Well, I think it was much harder core than they expected. The way Kamal Derwish had actually explained it to them was that, you know, there would be all these brothers together and that it was really quite a nice camp. And he sort of laid it out like it was going to be summer camp. And, in fact, it was very harsh, and the conditions were very harsh. They didn't like the food. They didn't like the water. They were scared while they were there. And a lot of this was all conducted in Arabic, and they spoke spotty Arabic at best. So for them, it was sort of just watching other people. And there were parts of it, certainly, that were fun. You know, they got to blow up a Russian tank and things like that. So for them, that was quite exciting. But in general, they found it to be much more anti-American than they anticipated. And, again, much, much harder core.
Mm-hmm.
There was actually a list that went around the camp for people to sign up to be a suicide bomber.
Mm-hmm. And at some point, Bin Laden shows up.
Yes, Bin Laden shows up actually at two different points. And I think this is when they actually realized how over their heads they were. I mean, Derwish had sort of been saying that they were going to meet the Sheikh, right, which was the name for Bin Laden amongst these followers. And they kind of thought he was full of a lot of hot air, and then Bin Laden actually appears, and he appears to talk about how the Islamic Jihad and Zarqawi and he are going to join forces, you know, to fight against the infidels. And it was during that meeting that he mentions that there are 40 men who are willing to take their souls into their hands, you know, for this fight. And it was the first sort of hint of the fact that the 9/11 plan was already, you know, launched. Naturally, the Lackawanna 6 didn't understand. There was no timing. There was no detail beyond these 40, you know, brothers who were willing to take their souls in their hands. But that came back to haunt them when they actually came back to the United States and were charged with material support for al-Qaeda.
Can you define jihad?
It's interesting because it has a number of different connotations depending on how you want to look at it. Some people think that it's a struggle to just be a better person. Some people think it has to be an armed struggle for your Islamic faith. And no one has been able to say definitively where along that whole spectrum it actually sits. And that's the reason why there's been so much confusion about this term jihad, because it is essentially so open to interpretation, it depends who says it.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call, Dina. This is a caller from Champaign. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, are you talking to me?
Yes, I'm talking to you. Welcome to Focus 580.
Thank you. Gosh, what a fascinating topic, and I'm sorry I missed the first few minutes of it, but I have two questions, and I realize that they're pretty broad, but number one, how did you gather this information? And number two, did you run into any opposition from, I don't know, the alphabet government people when you wanted to publish this book?
The way I gather the information is for the past 3 years I've been researching the book, spending a lot of time in Lackawanna and a lot of time sort of getting sources both in and out of law enforcement. So between all that, I compiled it and you know, wrote 75,000 words on it. In terms of opposition, the way I sold this to both sides of the story, and by both sides I mean the Lackawanna community and FBI and law enforcement, was that there was a lot of misunderstanding about what happened about the Lackawanna Six. I mean, if you go anywhere, and I've been doing these readings around the country, and I always start out by asking people, you know, how many of people have heard of the Lackawanna Six? And nearly everybody in the room raises their hands. And then I say, how many people think that they were railroaded and that they were essentially arrested for political reasons and were never going to be a sleeper cell? And about half the room raises their hands. And I said, how many of you think that they were real terrorists? And another half of the room raises their hands. So because of that sort of confusion over the story itself, it was pretty easy to say to the FBI, look, I'm going to write the definitive book on this to explain the truth about the Lackawanna Six. And I would say the same thing to the community, and that's how it worked out.
Well, I'm impressed with your skill at not only researching, but at getting this, you know, this information out to the public. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you, caller. I appreciate the call. The group are arrested a year later after they come back from the camps. It's very close to the anniversary of 9/11. The country is very pent up, wrought up at this first anniversary. You've got the terror levels going up, and we know what was going on. But how did that anniversary, if it did, influence the arrest at this time?
Well, I mean, I'm the FBI correspondent for NPR here in Washington, so you can imagine that my book has been read at the FBI. And Director Mueller is not, he's a little grumpy at me for something I put in the book, which had to do with this particular meeting that occurred between Vice President Dick Cheney, FBI Director Mueller, and President Bush. At the time, for months before the arrest, like 3 or 4 months before the arrest, Mueller was having to actually give a daily briefing to Bush and Cheney about what the Lackawanna Six were doing. This must have been an incredibly difficult thing for him to do, because day after day, the Lackawanna Six were pretty much acting normal, and they going about their business, trying to get back into their old lives. And it would have been so much easier if Mueller could actually say to Cheney, yeah, they went and bought explosives, yeah, they've got blueprints for this particular Niagara Falls, you know, electrical power plant, we're on them, we're just waiting for them to contact someone else, and then we're going to sweep them up. But instead, Mueller was having to say, actually, they're not doing much of anything. Yes, we're following their phone conversations and their email, and they're acting, occasionally they're acting suspicious because they know we're following them, so they're doing U-turns in the middle of the streets and that sort of thing, but we think we have a pretty good handle on this. To which Vice President Cheney said, can you give me 100% guarantee, and this would have been sort of late summer of 2002. Can you give me an absolute guarantee that these guys aren't going to do anything? And Mueller quite sensibly said, no, of course not. You know, nobody can say 100%, but we have a pretty good, you know, lid on these guys. And either Cheney or Bush, it's unclear, I've heard both versions of the story, said, you need to go arrest them. Now, Director Mueller doesn't deny the existence of that meeting. What he denies is that he arrested these guys for political reasons, and they were, or that the arrests were timed for the first anniversary of 9/11. But it stretches credibility that they just happened. The first one just happened to be arrested on September 9, and the rest of them, you know, arrested a day and a half later.
What's it like? Let's step out of the book for a second, but it's not too far away from the book. What's it like working with the FBI?
You know, in general, I think that out in the field offices, they are really salt of the earth people, and my experience with them has been almost uniformly positive. There are some people who perhaps have had a little bit too much of the Kool-Aid, as they say, and are maybe a little too exuberant. But in general, they really are trying to do the right thing. And they've got, to a really large extent, an almost impossible job. They have to, they've had to completely change their role from essentially crime-fighting to and building a case to actually preventing something before it happens. And that's a really big cultural difference that they're having to do. And there's also, of course, zero tolerance, right? I mean, we talk a lot about the civil liberties that we feel might be stomped upon as they do their job, but imagine if something like London had happened here. Mm-hmm. We'd be all over them like a rash.
The phone numbers again to call in and speak to Dina Temple Raston are 333-9455. Or 1-800-222-9455. Speaking of the London bombing, you do say the Lackawanna Six share similarities with the terrorists in the July 7th, 05 London bombing. What are those similarities?
Mostly demographics. You know, I mean, if you were to sort of take, you know, one of, for example, one of the Lackawanna Six is a guy named Sahim Alwan, who had a good job and a family and seemed sort of out of step with the rest of them. He was a little bit older than the rest of them. And then you remember there was, I think I have the name right, Mr. Khan, who was a teacher with a family who sort of led, or was one of the leaders of the London bombing plot. They have very similar demographics. Similarly, the other guys were in the London bombing plot were underemployed, had gone to madrasas, who had come to Islam late. Had been sort of party animals who sort of discovered Islam, very much similar to the Lackawanna Six. I mean, the big difference, of course, is that there's a difference in assimilation. And in the end, I mean, my theory is the reason why the Lackawanna Six never actually did anything or never planned to do anything was because, in fact, they were too assimilated. They were too American. And the idea of actually attacking America was an anathema to them.
Mm-hmm. You talk about them coming to the precipice, and the, but not crossing it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I just think, you know, it was funny because when Kamel Derwish was actually recruiting them, one of the things he kept on saying is, you guys are too American. You guys are too American. You've lost your Muslimness. And the truth is that he was essentially prescient in that fact because they didn't dive into this idea of jihad basically because they were too American.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another call, Dina. This is from Champaign. Go ahead, caller. Welcome to the show.
Hi, is that me?
Yep, that's you. Welcome to the show.
Hi, I was wondering, this book strikes me as a classic case of really investigative journalism of a kind that I don't see very much anymore, and certainly not about this issue. And I was wondering if you could maybe try to answer why that might be.
It takes a lot of time. For one thing, I also think the timing of this is such. I you know, when I first started the book 3 years ago, it was much harder to get this kind of information than it is now. I think we're starting to see much more of this investigative reporting coming out as I think people within the administration have become disillusioned and have started leaking in a way that they never did before. I think we also have a lot more distance on 9/11, and because we have that distance, I think we're questioning things much more. I mean, if
go ahead. Oh, no, I was just saying thanks.
And I think in a large sense, the book sort of, The Jihad Next Door, arrives on the scene at a really good time, because I think even people who are sort of hardcore, look, you know, if I'm not doing anything wrong, then I don't mind if they're looking into my emails or they're looking into my phone calls. I think people are starting to question whether or not they really feel that anymore now that they've gotten some distance on the 9/11 attacks.
I would disagree with the caller a little bit. I think this book is another bright, shining example of the health of journalism we have in this country. And we need to continue to support the nation's journalists and the institutions, universities, and publications and radio and TV stations that are associated with this important profession. We'll take another call now. This is from our good neighbors in Indiana over in Bloomington. Go ahead, caller.
Hi. You expressed the opinion that the reason the terrorists have not struck us again was because they were too American. Could I give another opinion and for your comment?
I'm not sure we heard that. We heard that from Dina.
Yeah, I think what I said was that in the end, the reason why these six young men did not go the full route and actually become jihadists and attack the United States was because they just had been here too long and were too American and wouldn't attract this country.
In other words, you were saying that they're too loyal to America? Is that it?
The six?
Say again?
The Lackawanna six? Yes.
Okay. Well, let me express the opinion that the terrorists may be withholding their terror because there's a great number of Americans who are asleep and don't think that they pose a threat. As a matter of fact, we have one of our Democratic presidential candidates even said that this whole war is nothing but a bumper sticker. It has no more importance than a bumper sticker. And of course, if they strike us again, it's perfectly obvious it'll be more than a bumper sticker. And maybe they don't want us to wake up. How about that?
Thank you, caller. Go ahead, Dina.
I'm not quite sure how to respond to that.
Let me take it into sort of that direction. I mean, you contend, and I don't think it's a wild jump to make this claim, that Muslims in the United States are under more scrutiny than non-Muslims. And some would say, as a counter to that, look, these are extraordinary times. The 19 hijackers on 9/11 were not atheists or Mormons or Buddhists. They were Muslims. And as that group, they hated everything about us. And the same could be said of the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993 and the bombings in Madrid, London, Bali. You can go on and on. So would it not be normal to attach extra scrutiny in predominantly Muslim communities such as Dearborn, Michigan and Lackawanna?
Yeah, I'm not. If you actually would talk to Muslims about this, they actually understand why the extra scrutiny is there. And scrutiny is, you know, I think I said this earlier when we were discussing this, that in fact these various homegrown terrorism plots that have been foiled since 9/11 in large part have been foiled with the help of the Muslim community.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that it cannot be underestimated, because we just don't have the human resources that we need in terms of law enforcement in these communities. We have to really count on the communities to tell us what's going on there or when they see something amiss. And that's the problem. You have to find that nice balance between actually, tracking someone who might be dangerous but not alienating the very people who are helping you fight this fight.
And I think this is a fascinating question. I mean, what is the line that we feel as Americans we cannot cross in order to ensure our safety? I mean, you recommend the highest standards of fairness and inclusiveness when we scrutinize people. But what is the line? I mean, you've been studying the FBI and security now for quite a while.
I think it changes, actually. Mm-hmm. And I think there was one line post 9/11. There's David Kay, who was the arms mm-hmm. inspector, who came back and finally said, look, there's no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. He said something very interesting post 9/11, which was what happened after the 9/11 attacks is that things in Iraq didn't change. Our threshold for danger changed. And in this country, our threshold for danger changed post 9/11. Things that we might have just seen as vaguely suspicious before, now we felt had to be given more scrutiny, just given what the experience was. And I think we're walking back from that now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're, individually even, I think that we're all trying to figure out where we feel comfortable in this broad spectrum. Do we feel uncomfortable with these national security letters that, you know, don't have the paperwork that's behind them? Do we feel comfortable with, you know, these big fishing expeditions using the telephone companies to try and get, you know, phone numbers that are connected to each other without a warrant? We're a little uncomfortable about that. The point I try to make is that what makes us wonderful about a country, and I'm exceedingly patriotic about the United States, even though I was born in Belgium, is that we hold ourselves to a higher standard. And in recent times, we have not held ourselves to the same high standard that we used to hold ourselves to. And I think that now the question that's coming out in this country is maybe we should go back to that high standard again. That's why we're uncomfortable with Guantanamo. That's why we're uncomfortable with things like Abu Ghraib. It doesn't matter that they don't hold themselves, they being the enemy, doesn't hold themselves to that standard. We have to, because that's what we're about.
Let's take another call, Dina. This is from Champaign. Go ahead, caller. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome.
I find this discussion fascinating. I'd like to ask the your guest to speak to the question of the let's call it the terminology that's used, that, you know, Muslims are terrorists, but McVeigh, Timothy McVeigh, is not a terrorist in the vocabulary of the government, and that there really are sort of fluid standards that you know, that seem to make one kind of indiscriminate violence just a local crime, or in the case of McVeigh, a national crime, and other kinds of violence, terrorism.
It's interesting that you mentioned Timothy McVeigh, because he actually has a tangential sort of role in this particular story. His father lived in Buffalo. And when the Murrow building was actually blown up, there was a tremendous amount of guilt among the investigators at the Buffalo field office, the FBI, because they felt that they should have seen this coming. You know, Timothy McVeigh actually applied for a job at the FBI Buffalo field office. And for them, they felt, you know, because they had to do a lot of the investigation after the Murrow building to make sure that Timothy McVeigh, you know, had acted on his own, that there wasn't some other conspiracy going on in Buffalo. They interviewed his father and his sister. And to them, this brought this idea of homegrown terrorism into very stark relief as to what was at stake and how bad it could be. And I would disagree with the caller in just this one sense. I think that we call Timothy McVeigh a terrorist. I think we call him a homegrown terrorist, and he's considered, you know, one of the early ones in this sort of modern day of homegrown terrorism. So I'm not sure that distinction you know, if you're Muslim, you're a terrorist, and if you're not Muslim, then you're something else. I think that we actually have a pretty large tent for terrorists these days.
I would agree, too. I have not heard the word terrorist not associated with Timothy McVeigh. I mean, every time you think about that horrible act, you think of terrorism,
right,
and domestic terrorism. Let's talk again, get back to this level of what we will accept as a country to protect us. It seems like there's a growing voice saying we will not accept Guantanamo, we will not accept Abu Ghraib. But there's a portion of your book that is so evocative, and I think it's very important. It's in chapter 13, and this again goes back to Kamel Derwish and about his demise. He was obviously hanging around a lot of bad people in Yemen, including al-Qaeda's top man in Yemen at the time. But he's taken out by this predator drone, which I guess is controlled in Virginia or somewhere like that.
Well, you can see what it sees in at Langley. And in fact, George Tenet was watching the screen as it was sort of zeroing in on this convoy. But they had to be, I think they were, I'm sorry, I can't remember this off the top of my head, but I think that they were actually controlling it from Dubai or one of the Middle Eastern states.
Mm-hmm. And so they take out the Al-Qaeda top man in Yemen, very happy about it. And I remember there was, you know, they break into the news to tell you what's going on and actually maybe even show us what's happening. But in the car, of course, is Kamel Dervish. And this, a lot of people have made a point of this, and maybe not as loudly as they should, that this was an assassination. In Dervish's case, especially.
Of an American.
Of an American, without a trial, without charges being leveled, without a jury, without due process. What's your take on that? And I do want to tell the readers that there's a defense of this by Secretary of Defense at the time, Donald Rumsfeld, who says, "We'd all like the dots connected for us with a ribbon wrapped around it. Americans want evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. We want to be able to be certain that you know before anyone's punished. You've got the wrong model in our minds if you're thinking about punishment." Again, Rumsfeld's quotes are fascinating, always fascinating. But maybe you could talk a little bit about this. It seems to me this is a line that we should not have crossed.
I would agree with that. Mm-hmm. I think, actually, I would back it up a little bit, although I'm pretty careful in the book. I hope I'm careful enough in the book not to say where I stand on these things. I try to present them so the reader can decide where they stand on them.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think I would back it up even further to say that I have a problem with the Guantanamo Bay issue, which is one step below that, of not being able to have due process of law in Guantanamo, some sort of due process of law. I mean, Juma al-Dosri, who is this guy who came to sort of give a second opinion about whether or not these guys could possibly become good Muslims if they didn't go and train for jihad, he was from Indiana. He was an imam. It's unclear whether he really had any al-Qaeda connection at all or whether Kamel Dervish sort of just brought him in for a second opinion. He ended up in Guantanamo Bay for 5 years. And there's a movie called Road to Guantanamo, which has its own sort of issues. But one scene in the movie actually has this particular inmate being beaten to a pulp, almost to a death, by the sort of rapid reaction force that's in Guantanamo Bay. Well, that person that was almost beaten to death was Juma al-Dosri.
Mm-hmm.
And the FBI actually went down there to investigate the beating. And for a long time, it was hard for me to figure out where Juma al-Dosri was, because you will recall that for a long time they wouldn't tell anybody who was actually in Guantanamo Bay. And Juma's name surfaced sort of accidentally in some papers that I saw, and I ended up being able to run that to ground. You know, he was never indicted for anything. Lackawanna was never even mentioned. He was in Guantanamo Bay for being supposedly present at Tora Bora. But he was turned over to U.S. forces by a Pakistani army guy who said he was al-Qaeda and wanted to collect a $10,000 reward. You've got to sort of wonder about that.
Mm-hmm. And he did try to kill himself. He was so distraught.
Six or seven times.
Yeah, he's now freed from
Guantanamo. He's in Saudi Arabia, in fact. And I remember when he got out in July, and I remember that when that happened, you know, all my sources in the FBI said, "Oh, you know, don't think that this isn't going to be anything. You know, he's going to be thrown back into jail in the Saudis." And instead, the Saudis actually flew his parents to Riyadh to greet him, and he's free today.
Mm-hmm. Let's jump over to another call. Let's take this call from West Chicago. Caller, go ahead. You're on the air. Go ahead, caller. Nope. Well, we have a little difficulty now. We're bringing him. Yes, we can hear you now. Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, sorry.
You're cutting out on us. Let's go over to Urbana, Illinois, and take a call right here in Urbana. Hello, caller. Welcome to Focus 580. Go ahead.
Yes. The earlier caller seemed to imply that there were a number, probably a great number, of terrorists, whatever they are, among the American Islamic community. And this is problematical for me. First, the community is very disparate. It's Arab, Iranian, American, Native American, Black, East Asian, Pakistani. And it's very hard to group all of these people together. So that, to me, is a problem. But even more so, it doesn't seem to me there's any evidence of this. What few terrorist attacks there have been in the United States, it seems to me that these have all been non-American individuals, that they're from outside.
Well, except that, no, there have been Americans, actually. But your point about the...
But very few.
Very few. Agree.
Okay.
But your point about the Muslim community is a really good one. It's we sort of, and in fact, I would say that we could actually say this about the Lackawanna Six as well. We tend to group people together with these very general nouns, like Muslims in America, and there's a whole sort of rainbow of people there, the same way that we say Lackawanna Six is a sleeper cell, or some people say that. And frankly, all six of them had a different view, and they ran the entire spectrum from, uh-oh, I should have never gone to Afghanistan, to I'm willing to martyr myself.
Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful article that Dina wrote for the Washington Post called The Enemy Within. There's a question mark at the end of that. Reflections on the Role of the Lackawanna Six. And it's on the web. You can find it. It was published in the September 17th through 23rd weekly edition, at least, of the Washington Post. That's where I found it. And in that article, Dina writes, "Selectively abandoning civil liberties and due process to wage war on terrorism only plays into bin Laden's hands. Al-Qaeda succeeds at changing America simply by threatening it." Can you explain that statement?
It gets back to this idea of standards that I was talking about earlier, that we hold ourselves to a higher standard. And because we haven't done that recently, because we haven't held ourselves to the standards that we used to hold dear, bin Laden can make a pretty good case that we are unfair and hypocritical and ungodly and all these other things that he's been able to say. I mean, he said the same thing about Afghanistan, or going into Iraq. Everything that he has said, unfortunately, we have played somewhat into his hands.
Mm-hmm. I know you must get this question repeatedly, Dina, but I'll ask it anyway. Why is it, do you think, that there's not been another terrorist attack in the U.S. since 9/11? Are we just lucky, or can we praise? Okay. The second part of my question was, can we praise some of the new and controversial security measures in place?
I think some of those have to do with it, too, to give everything its due. But to a large extent, we've been very lucky. They have been able to foil things just in time.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another call. This one from Champaign County. Go ahead, caller. Welcome to Focus 580.
Thank you. You're being very careful not to take a real dramatic stance on this, but I'm one of the people that think that this was a railroad. Now, I don't know if it applies to actually all of them, but if you look at what the administration has done at various times, they've had these extremely convenient timing moments where this fellow in Pakistan who was, the intelligence people in England were furious with the U.S. for revealing the name of this guy because they were still using an informant. I'm not remembering his name right now, but it's so manipulative. It's astonishing that we can still have people that don't realize that they're actually manipulating to such an extent. And I just wanted you to react to that, and I'd like for you to be a little more forthright on what you really feel about how clear you think the evidence is that that at least a group of this where you stand on their innocence, I guess.
Thank you, caller.
Well, there are gradations of this. I would say, to be honest, I don't think that they were a sleeper cell. And I think that calling them that was very manipulative and was done on the anniversary of 9/11, in my opinion, for purely political reasons so that they could say they were winning the war on terror. And the people who are closest to the case, for example, the prosecutor, the U.S. prosecutor there, who's a guy named Mike Battle, was very careful never to call them a sleeper cell. But Ashcroft was very quick in doing so. So, yes, there's a tremendous amount of manipulation that goes on. Do I think, honestly, that if you go to an Al-Qaeda camp and learn about plastic explosives that you can be just watched in this age of terror? I don't. I think that the Lackawanna Six all had to go to jail. Do I think that they needed to be presented as this nefarious sleeper cell? No. I think they should have been presented as six guys who went to an Al-Qaeda camp, may not have understood exactly what they were doing, but it's against the law to do that. Material support. You guys are going to jail.
Mm-hmm.
I think, actually, of the various cases that we have, this one is a bit of a slam dunk. I think there are problems with the case, for example, in Miami, where they arrested some guys as supposedly wanting to blow up the Sears Tower. And, you know, they didn't have the means. They weren't Muslim. They had started their own religion. They were clearly a little bit crazy. And if you talk to the FBI about various cases, that's one that makes them nervous. But the Fort Dix case, these guys who wanted to attack the army base, who were former, you know, Bosnians, you know, they were buying guns to do it. Would they have been able to attack and do what they said they wanted to do to the army base? No, but they could have done something very much like, you remember there was that, and now I've forgotten his name, but there was a terrorist who actually shot at a bunch of people who were at a choke point going into the CIA. And that was what eventually the FBI was worried the Fort Dix guys would do, that they would maybe not be able to throw, you know, grenades and kill tons of army guys within the base, but in fact decide instead that they just sort of use their guns to mow these guys down as they were waiting to go into work.
Well, Dina, our hour is up, and I want to thank you so much. This was a great conversation and very stimulating with Dina Temple Raston. She's the author of The Jihad Next Door, The Lackawanna Six, and The Rough Justice in the Age of Terror. Thank you all for calling. Thank you, Dina.
You bet.